Mr. Holdsworth, Reel 4. You were just saying about how the officer had stayed on the ship.
Oh yes, Karen had stayed on the ship. So we'd picked up the rest of the crew from Hong Kong and then went up to the Yangtze, and we were supposed to be going down to meet the Amethyst and put the rest of the crew on board the Amethyst. Anyway, we met the Amethyst steaming up the Yangtze towards us, and Karen's refused to have the rest of the crew put on. Wanted all the glory himself, you see. And these people on board were really annoyed, you know. And they were saying, you know, all these bloody cowards had stayed on, and now we're all making this big publicity about, you know. And we had to take them back to Hong Kong. They joined the thing at Hong Kong, you know. It was a real farce.
And was he decorated for this?
Oh, yes, and then became a Tory MP.
So, what was the rest of your involvement in the Korean War?
Well, then we went to Japan, and we were doing a tour, and we're in Kyoto when we were received orders and went off on the west coast of Japan to join Admiral Joy, who was the admiral in charge on this battlecruiser Juno. And he was there with the battlecruiser Juno and two destroyers. And the British contingent was the Jamaica and the Black Swan, a frigate. And we were like operating on the west coast, bombarding ammunition trains that were coming, trucks coming down the roads, because it was mountainous, the west coast of Korea. And they were sending convoys along the roads, and we were bombarding them, and then firing over the mountain range, giving some support to the American troops and South Koreans that were trapped in this enclave around Busan. We were hit. The captain was one of these glory boys as well, you know, a Lord Louis Mountbatten thing. Put the ship in danger, sort of.
What was his name?
I forget what he was called now. And we anchored a mile offshore, bloody anchored. And this shore battery opened up on us. The classic range finding, one over us, one short, and then one hit the mast, anti-personnel. Killed about 13, I think it was. And it exploded above them and it stripped them down. Somewhere in it was the pom-pom deck, and the ammunition lockers were there with the doors open, and some were stood in between the doors, and they didn't have a scratch on them. Yeah, all the mates were stripped down, stripped all the head. They were just a bubble, you know. Top all the heads had disappeared, and all the flesh. We went up to bring them down, and it was like a butcher shop up there. I mean, there were meat all over the place. It was hanging from them. And cussy up tanker, and we were away then. But and also, I went off religion quite a bit then, because we had a parson on board who was really glorifying this killing them, you know. But then, after we'd buried these, we're in this other action with the Juno and these two destroyers and the Black Swan, or the Dirty Duck, as we called it. And there was these... The North Koreans had these American P-boats, like the ones that John F. Kennedy, he commanded one, you know, when he was a hero in the Pacific War. Motor torpedo boat. And they had six of these, I think it was. And they were convoying these ammunition barges down the coast, because we were shooting up the roads. And when they saw us, and we saw them, they all detached from the convoy and attacked us. These six, I mean, big capital ships and these six bloody P-boats attacking us. And we fired 2,000 rounds of 6-inch ammunition at them. It was like those films of the war in the Pacific, where the air, you know, they're fighting the kamikazes, and the air's full of black shrapnel. It was like, at one period, us and the Juno were firing on each other because they were going in between us. I mean, it was... We fired 20-odd thousand rounds of small arm stuff, pom-poms and Orlikans and Bofors. I mean, it was unbelievable, the amount of stuff that was being fired. One of them escaped out to sea, pursued by the Black Swan, and the other ones we shot up. And we picked up survivors. There was one that was coming straight for us. Well, we carried 21-inch torpedoes in turrets, two turrets. And the torpedo operator sat on top of the turrets, you know, in a little control thing, because you could send the torpedoes off in Ws or what have you, Zs. And they reported that these things were coming straight at them. Well, they could see the torpedoes on the tape. And apparently, what we heard after, they'd fired the torpedoes, but the firing circuit had been shot away. Because we'd have blown up if they'd have hit us in the torpedo. And these were shitting themselves on the torpedo decks, I'll tell you. And we picked them up, and we thought they were real heroes. I mean, taking on big ships with these bloody little boats, I mean, it was inevitable to get massacred. The amount of guns we had on us. And so we treated them with real respect. I mean, when you're fighting somebody, you have a real respect for them. Because you know how frightened you are. You know, and there they are, these attacking you. You know, but they must be frightened as well. And we were like the big one. These were the little ones that had attacked us. So we had quite a respect for them. And we took them back to Kure. And when we got to Kure, the Americans came to take them. And we couldn't believe it. There they were with these machine weapons. And they were hitting with the butts, come on, you know. Because they were losing at the time. And the ship's company lined the ship and were throwing stuff at these Americans, orange peel and all this, you know, and shouting at them and that, because they were so angry at the way these prisoners were being treated, because we thought they were bloody heroes, you know. So you started to wonder what the hell were they fighting at. How could they be so heroic? All this about communism and all this, you know. But if it was so bad, why were these fighting so heroically for it, you know? So, and this pass and all this rubbish, so you began to be a bit more open-minded, you know, you didn't sort of take the propaganda in.
Before we get onto this, if I just ask you a bit about the combat itself. You described this captain as a bit of a glory boy. What are you implying by that he actually put people's lives in danger for his own glory? What do people think of that then?
Well, it was like Lord Louis in the Med. I mean, on the Kelly, he was captain of the Kelly. He used to dread being drafted to the Kelly, as he knew that this bugger would be risking the ship. You know, all these heroics and that. It wasn't just his bloody life he was risking, it was all the men. And, it was well known. There are the glory boys in, you know, that are after. Because it's such a rat race. I mean, if you look at the figures now, what is it? I think there's 600 captains. It was in The Guardian a couple of days ago, 600 captains. And there was about 19 of them actually got a ship. Was it 19 or 39? A small number. And the rest are doing desk jobs. You know, well, the only way you get promotion is by making a name for yourself. You know, Cairns came up from a lieutenant right away to a lieutenant commander. Well, you retire at the rank above you were. So he's commander when he retired, Commander Cairns, you see. But if you can get to commander, you're captain when you retire. You get a captain's pension. So they're all booking for rank, you know, and it's a real rat race. They all know to a minute when the other captains joined and so on. So, and the ship's company are very conscious of this, you know.
So, was there ever any question of people refusing to obey him when they realised that?
No. He's like a god, the captain. He can have you hung. I mean, he can still have you hung to the yardarm.
Even though people knew they were risking their lives.
Oh, aye.
And what was it like for you? This was the first time, wasn't it, you'd actually been under fire?
Yes, yeah.
Presumably you can never tell how each person's going to react. Did anyone go mad? Did anyone hide? Or
No. At first, when it happened, it was unreal. You just pick them up, they were like a butcher shop. It's a few hours after where you get the shakes, you know, and a lot of us got the shakes, where the shock, delayed shock sort of it, of seeing human beings like this, you know, then you start to think about it. And also, there was a few volunteered to help in the hospital because there was a lot of operations. These were the dead ones, but there was quite a few that was injured. And we had quite a good surgeon on. He was a drunkard, but he operated better when he'd had a few drinks, you know. And he was apparently useless when he was sober. So there are all these legends, of course. I mean, you never know whether they're true, but he always smelt a bit of drink. And this guy was helping out and had got the parts in a bucket. We're supposed to throw the bucket over the side, see? But he tipped it over the side. Everybody was. But you thought about it. You'd not thought about being killed until you saw some people killed. And we had this Chief Torpedo Coxswain, who was, his action station was in one of the ammunition rooms. And he was on about telling all these young ODs that he had down there, telling them all over the experiences during the war, where they were locked in, you see, in ammunition, you clamped in, because you're at action stations, you see. How they'd been attacked, and all the water was coming in, and they were trapped, and they were screaming to get out, and fighting each other to get to the things, and all these ODs, you know, frightened to bloody death with it.
Why were they clamped in?
Well, to maintain watertight, you know, compartments. So if you were hit, I mean, it was bloody tough luck on them. You know, they couldn't get out.
Before you actually engaged, I mean, you knew what was about to happen. What did you talk to people then? You know, did you think about what was about to happen? How did you feel before?
No. I mean, you didn't know it was about to happen.
You didn't.
No. I mean, we were just bombarding this road. You could see the convoys, and you could see, you know, our shot and all that. But you don't expect them to shoot back at you. You know? I mean, they got field guns because it was a modern type army, a field army, the North Koreans, tanks and whatever. And we should have known. I mean, the Amethyst in London was shot up with bazookas. They weren't without arms. So it was like the taste of us getting it back. The big colonial power firing shells at them, and then they started firing back. But we didn't anchor a mile offshore again. You know.
During that period, did you, when you were out in Korea, did you go ashore anywhere at all?
In Korea? No, we weren't.
No, whilst you were on that operation?
Oh, in Japan we did, yeah. Because you did a patrol, and then you came back and had a week or so in Sasebo, which became the United Nations headquarters. And, I mean, we clashed there with the Americans.
Can you tell me a bit about what the situation was there? There were a lot of American troops there, were there?
It was the main United Nations naval port in Japan, Sasebo. So you'd... it was newly set up, because, as I said, we were the first ships involved, the Juno and ourselves and these two destroyers and the Black Swan. So that was us at the time. Later on, we had Canadian, Australian, New Zealand navies sent ships as well. But we were there originally, and it had just been set up. They got new MPs, shore patrols, come from the States and that. And I remember we went ashore, and of course, we were competing with the Americans. And they'd on big wages, and we were on small wages, as is known. MacArthur was supremo of Japan, was like military ruler of Japan. And he'd put this decree out that we weren't to use Japanese eating houses, like their restaurants. Well, of course, we were supposed to use the American PX, but we'd have to pay American prices. So we couldn't afford that. So when we went ashore, we were all sneaking into these Japanese eating houses. And you could get steak, egg and chips. and a bottle of beer for quite a reasonable sum, you know. Well, we could afford it. And I remember there was three of us, Bertie Bell, McCloughrey and myself, in this little cafe. And we were just finishing the meal, this beer, when these two MPs came in, all the white helmets and white webbing, these great big revolvers, 45s they were. And these two said to us, "Come on, Limeys, you're not allowed in here." So we said, "Right on, mate." I mean, we were being friendly. "Right on, we'll just finish off." You know. And this guy had his gun out right away, you know. He was dying to bloody shoot us as well. So it scared the wits out of you. One of these big things point at you. Because we'd fired them ourselves, you know, so we knew it, because we're all ex-boy seamen, McCloughrey and Bell. And we went out, and apparently, they've been having a load of trouble with these MPs, our people in the town. I mean, any slight signs of drink, and the sake, you know, we were drinking quite a lot of that, the rice wine, is quite potent. They were picking them up, taking them, and putting them in this compound on the pier, you know, like a prison sort of set up they had. And they'd been beating them up with the batons as well, you know, they were in a sorry state, quite a lot of them. And we'd not got all night leave, we had to be, I think it was 12 o'clock leave, and we all went back to the pier to catch the pinnace back, the Liberty boat, and there's quite a lot of us on the thing, and there'd been a lot of talk of the treatment by the Yanks. And we're having a bit of a sing-song. I mean, it was just a boozy sing-song. And this jeep rolled up on the pier with this patrol, and they jumped out and started saying, telling us to stop singing. So they all turned on them and picked them up and threw them into the sea, and then they picked the jeep and threw that in the sea. And, it was completely spontaneous, supported by everybody. Everybody was really delighted, you know, to see them going. And then our officer, the patrol, was a commissioned warrant officer, came rushing down, you know, to try and stop it all a bit too late, with the patrol who were keeping well back from him. And as he came running down, somebody nudged him in as well. You know, it was quite funny. And then the pinnace came, and they'd picked up at this other pier first. And as they came alongside, they were all beard up and singing. They were all nudging him back into the water, you know, the poor guy nearly drowned, so it was quite a funny thing. But the antagonism...
you say the patrol were hanging back from him when he turned up.
Oh, aye.
What patrol was that, do you mean?
Our shore patrol, because each ship had its own shore patrol. But they'd got overall command, these Americans, which were full-time shore patrol. But after they replaced this, and it must have been because of this antagonism, and they set up a United Nations Shore Patrol, which was two Americans, two New Zealanders, two Australians, two Canadians, two of us.
And just before you mention that, this antagonism, was it, you know, purely on the basis of the struppy behaviour of the MPs and so on? Or was it also, was there any resentment, any sort of feeling that, what are we doing going fighting America's war? Was there anything like that?
No, we didn't.
So purely just from this.
We believed, you know, it was United Nations. I mean, although all the evidence pointed it to being American, we believed it, you know, because, I mean, we were indoctrinated when the communists had started the war. Instead, it wasn't the South that had, the Americans in the South that had started it, it was the North. And, I mean, the communists were after dominating the world. I mean, the standard slogan was, there ought to be atom bomb from here to Moscow, sort of, you know.
So anyway, they set up this joint patrol as a response to it.
Yeah. They got this hotel in Sasebo. And first of all, it was on a ship. And then it went into this hotel. And once it was in the hotel, it was American messing allowance. So it was, you know, a plum job. But everybody just got rid of I don't know whether I was seen as one. But they got rid of the hard cases, you know. Certainly these Americans, they were like mafia.
So you were one of the patrol?
Yes,
you were one of the British patrol representatives?
Yeah.
You and who else?
Yeah, I forget what he was called now.
Did you know him at the time?
Yes, he was off
from
to Jamaica.
Ship,
yeah.
So tell us a bit about your activities on the shore patrol.
Oh, it was generally, it was like a mafia operation. We were supposed to stop them using the brothels. And, I mean, they'd forgot about these restaurants and all that then. But it was the brothels that we were supposed to stop them using. But we let them use the brothels, those brothels that paid us a kickback. And the place was full of beer and spirits and all that.
You're talking about your own headquarters?
This hotel, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had these Japanese servants who were doing all the cooking and cleaning and all that. And we were living the life of Riley. It wasn't very long, though, because we were called back to the ship.
Before you talk about being called back, what kind of fiddles were you running there then?
Well, they had all cigarettes and all that. I mean, the owners of these brothels used to be bringing cigarettes and drink and all this and cash to the hotels. I mean, it was these Americans that got it. When we got there, these Americans already had it organised.
And they expected you to fit in.
Oh, yeah, we did.
And you did without too many qualms.
Oh, they said, shut that brothel down and we'd go and, you know, blockade it, put a sort of a picket on it. Oh, aye. And the dance halls too, you know, we'd shut them down too. Oh, aye, we soon fell into it.
What was the, what was life ashore like? I mean, there's the popular image, you know, and the Navy having a run ashore is fairly debauched. And what was the reality
like? Yeah, it was fairly debauched.
So it was.
The Japanese were a defeated people. The main way they lived, survived as a family, was having the daughters in prostitution, or the dance girls, what have you. So, I mean, that was what they were doing. And the girls were sort of keeping the families.
And was it sort of expected of you to go and visit prostitutes to get drunk and so on? Was that expected? If you didn't, you'd have been thought a bit odd, would you?
Yeah,
if you didn't fit into that. So
all the sailors on the ship would be behind that. And the Americans had introduced black market streptomycin and penicillin, but had not told them what doses to take. So they developed strains of penicillin and streptomycin resistance gonorrhea. So on the ships, they used to have a VD lineup. Used to fall in for captain's rounds three deep. There was a hell of a lot of that. So certainly the younger ones were very wary.
Was it an offence to catch VD?
Oh, aye. Yeah, because the lead stopped.
Was that because by implication you visited a brothel? That was the
reasoning, no, no.
Was it?
It was because you weren't
looking after yourself.
Probably fit for work.
I
heard people didn't like to. Well, they didn't like to eat off the same plates and all that, you know. That's the gonorrhea.
I've heard that even, sticking with the gonorrhea and stuff, yeah. I've heard that even catching sunstroke was an offence.
Oh, aye, too true. When we went to South Africa, you know, with the King on the Implacable, as we came out of the bay, ooh, terrible weather. It was so bad it had smashed up a couple of the destroyers' escorts and they'd had to turn back to Gibraltar, you know. When we first got the sun, you know, the weather changed and the sun came out, some were on the flight deck sunbathing and, of course, got sunburnt right away. As soon as you were sunburnt, you were unfit for work, so they stopped paying leave. Well, it was an offence. You were up before on Officer Day's report right away.
Yeah.
Oh, so that's where you found out about vinegar and water. Because you had to be able to work. Well, if you were sunburned, you couldn't.
What do you mean by vinegar and water?
Well, if you put vinegar and water on it, it takes all the sting out of it. So you can work, you know.
Right. So when you went ashore, you're saying that you lived the typical Navy life. What about the attitudes of the average sort of sailor to natives generally. If you went to a place like Japan or later when you were out in Malaya, were they seen as, you know, wogs? Were they just inferior generally, you know, foreigners? Would they treat the population badly or?
Well, no, I don't know, all the ones I was with, the people I was with, all saw them as just ordinary people. I mean, when we went to Jamaica, we went to Kingston and Jamaica, the first part of the tour, before we'd left for the Far East. I mean, there was a lot of blacks there. You go to the Myrtle Bank Hotel, which is like a Hilton there, and then all surrounding it are these tin shanty towns where the blacks live. You know, corrugated iron, chicken hut hatches, right? And even the bars are like that, you know. And we were very sympathetic with the blacks. We felt quite, you know, akin to them, identified with them, sort of. And in fact, we met some that had been the RAF regiment and that had been demobbed and straight out there, and then no dole or anything, you know. And that was it. They were on this scrap heap. So, no, I don't think...
Would you mix much with them insofar as there was any opportunity to? Or would you just, or would the only people you meet be sort of people running bars and prostitutes and people like that? Would
no, you did meet people. Not very many. You generally went out with a mate and then went to a bar and had a few drinks, got to a show or something. Went to this classical Japanese show, you know. You couldn't understand what the bloody hell it was all about. But you went, you'd have a meal, and just have a drink and a social evening sort of thing. That was what it was mainly.
And again,
I mean, we didn't have all that much money. Right? The Americans were determining the price of everything, which was geared to their wages. So we had a simple life ashore, you know. Mm. Everything was geared to them.
Apart from the people who inevitably you'd bump into, you know, trying to hustle for this and that, trying to get your money, the other people that you did meet, insofar as you could meet, just ordinary people, what do you think their attitude was towards British troops?
They saw us all the foreign occupiers. I mean, we went on tours. We went to Nagasaki, Hiroshima. We climbed up Fujiyama. And... went to all these big gardens and, you know, pagodas and Buddhist shrines and all that. Yokosuka, Yokohama, Tokyo. And they were a defeated people. It was pretty obvious. They couldn't understand you, and you couldn't speak Japanese. They seemed quite friendly. They were very submissive. You know, they felt they'd been defeated. But quite friendly and quite pleasant, you know. They seemed okay.
And what about the blacks in Jamaica?
Yeah, we were very friendly to them. We identified with them rather than the whites, who were the well-to-do.
But what did they think of you, then?
They were quite friendly.
Yeah.
They were quite friendly with us. They would talk to them and all that. Yeah. Aye. We got on all right with them.
So going on to...
I mean, that was us. A lot went to the Fleet Club and was just tipping beer down all night.
So do you think in that respect you're untypical?
No, it was two groups. One went walking around and went on the beaches and that and sightseeing. And the others, the older end, were all, you know, straight to the beer house and get blind drunk.
So it was a lot to do with your age, was it?
Yeah, because they were on more money than us as well, you know.
Was it also that they'd seen it all before?
Maybe.
But you were fairly curious yourself.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was just to get off the bloody ship, you know.
So you also were involved in the Malayan emergency.
Hmm.
What were you doing there?
Well, we were called to Hong Kong.
What ship was this?
Jamaica. And we took the 41st Royal Marine Commandos, a detachment from Hong Kong, to Penang.